If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, August 21st, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we are going to be gathering around the virtual water cooler and talking about what we've been up to. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
All right, Jacob, let's jump into it. What have you been doing recently?
I spent a few days in New York City, first time in there since 2006, I think, for me. And it was actually technically a work trip. I'm allowed to tell you that it was for the Beetlejuice Junket. Our first wave of coverage is actually live on the site. So if you want some quotes from that event, you can find them, you know, right now. I can't say more than that, though. But I will say that traveling up New York City for work, you know, did give me some free time. So I was able to see the city a bit and explore a bit.
So what was your favorite tourist activity or site that you saw while you were there?
I mean, I don't mean to be a cliche, but the Metropolitan Museum of Art is probably one of the great American treasures. Just an absolutely outstanding place, a place to get lost in. I mean, I like art museums in general. I always try to seek them out and explore them. And I think what makes the Metropolitan Museum of Art special is that it's such a designed space. It's so easy to feel like you are in a labyrinth, or so easy to like wander and feel like, oh, how did I get here? I mean, it's the same reason why I love like a theme park. I mean, it's not that I'm a Disney fan. It's that I'm a theme park fan. I'm a fan of designed spaces, of places where somebody put effort into, okay, how will somebody experience or navigate this created space? Mm-hmm. And of course, Metropolitan Museum of Art is a very different vibe than like, you know, Disneyland, for example. But both of them share the idea of, okay, how will people enjoy being here? And just spending 4 hours in a museum and feeling like I just scratched the surface and feeling like I missed things for sure, and not knowing how I got from one area to another, like just starting in an area with Egyptian art and ending up, you know, in modern 20th century art, and not 100% sure the path, but I took that path and I ended up here. And the feeling of both excitement and intimidation to backtrack and try to find what I missed, and realizing that there are 18 more routes to that museum that I just didn't know were there. I just love that museum. And I had, like I said, it's one of those things where there are things that are obvious, like Metropolitan Museum of Art, Central Park, the New York subway system. It's stuff that to me, you know, is either, you know, a cliche to locals or something that's very normal to locals, or in the case of the subway, something that people complain about regularly. But, you know, for my 5 days up there, I'm like, man, I could live here. This is great. I would love to have this world-class park and world-class museum and, you know, a subway system at my disposal. But like I said, I say that as somebody who's there for 5 days. I understand, like, if I live there permanently, there will be other backsides to it. But yeah, I did all the touristy things in my immediate area. The one thing I did, Ben, where I felt immediate revulsion, like if those of you who longtime Slashfilm readers and listeners, you know that Hoi Chen Bui, who used to be a Slashfilm editor and writer, she lives in New York, and we met up and we hung out for a bit. We went to the Museum of Moving Image together and had food. And I told her that, you know, I'm a touristy guy. I like tacky things as well as classy things. I don't go wander around Times Square. And she said, Jacob, no, please don't do that. And I went to Times Square, and it was the worst thing I've ever. It was the worst place I've been in a long time.
Oh,
New York City, New York City is an incredible city. Can't say enough nice things about the food I had, the museums I visited. Museum Moving Image was also great. I know people, it has a reputation for being a rude city, but it's not. It's just a fast city. You know, I had a great time everywhere I went except for Times Square, which is also the one place where somebody tried to rob me, where somebody tried to get in my backpack and steal my stuff. So don't go to Times Square if you're a tourist. It sucks.
Okay, well, good piece of advice. I'm glad that you were able to thwart the potential robber. But yeah, NYC, baby. Greatest city in the world. I don't know.
Have you been there?
I have. It's been a while, but I think it's been like 10 years or so since I've been.
Yeah. I will say, though, flying out, trying to fly out. There, a storm was on the East Coast. I'm trying to fly out. And if you've ever, if you have not spent 30 hours trapped between airports, in my case, I think four different airports, four different planes. I don't recommend it, because getting out of New York during weather openings was one thing. Then getting to a city where I can get connections home was the other thing. And the sheer physical and mental exhaustion of being trapped in an airport is maybe my least favorite thing ever, Ben. I can't think of a, I know it's a first world problem, but man, just the purgatory of an airport is a special kind of miserable.
Yeah, it really is pretty brutal. I've experienced that a couple times over the past few years, and it's just like, I just want to go home, man. Like, there's got to be a way to get me home. And I don't know, this might be a false memory, but in my mind, airlines used to work, like, cooperate. And I don't know, maybe somebody can fact check me on this or write in and let me know if you work for an airline or anything. But I feel like when I was a kid, and this could just be my perception, but I feel like airlines used to collaborate. If you got canceled, if your flight got canceled, then there was no other way to get you home. I feel like Delta would be like, all right, we'll find a United flight just to get you home tonight or something. And obviously that doesn't happen anymore. If it ever did in real life, this could be like a Berenstain Bears type of situation or something, a Mandela effect for me. But anyway, it's capitalism really sucks is what it boils down to. Yeah.
I'll tell you what they told me after my 3.5 hour long wait to get rebooked after my flight was canceled. 3.5 hours in a line, get to the front and be told, yeah, we're not flying out of JFK for 48 more hours. And because it was an act of God, meaning the weather, and not a problem with the Delta plane itself, we do not have to get you a hotel. We do not have to rebook you.
Wow. And that's it? They just left it at that?
They ended up rebooking me. I was polite and they found a way. But like I heard there were flights that evening from other airlines, but they wouldn't rebook me on those. So I ended up having to fly to Boston to get out of New York so I can have other options.
Man, yeah, brutal stuff. Brutal. I'm sorry you went through that, man.
No, but I want to point out that New York City, though, awesome place. And I spent most of my time in Manhattan. And as long as you don't block the sidewalk, as long as you know to step to the side when you check your Google Maps, great place. Just don't be the person who pauses in the middle of the sidewalk to check your Google Maps. Don't be that person. New Yorkers hate you and fast tourists hate you.
Okay, let's get into what we've been reading. I read a book that you talked about not too long ago on this show. It's called Dark Matter by Blake Crouch. And I pretty much echo everything that you said on that episode. I really enjoyed reading this. I thought it was incredibly propulsive. I think you mentioned it's only 300 pages or something, but it's a very, very, very fast read. And I loved the writing style. A lot of times when I read stuff these days, whatever author I'm reading has some sort of tick or some little something, some little stylistic flourish that they do that kind of gets under my skin a little bit. Since I'm an editor and I read people's work all day and edit things and get things to exactly the way that I think that they should be and up to the standards of Slash Film before stuff gets published, it bothers me sometimes reading other people's stuff and being like, man, was there no editor here? Like, why is there not a comma in the sentence when there absolutely should be one? You know, like just little stupid things like that. It's like bring my work home with me. But I didn't really have any problems at all with Blake Crouch's prose or writing style or anything. So, and that's like kind of rare these days for me to experience an author like that. So I just started last night his other book, Recursion, or one of his many other books. So I'll talk about that when I'm done with it, but I really enjoyed Dark Matter. I'm not going to really get into what it's about because I want to preserve some of the surprise, but Jacob, you described it as like a college professor gets involved in a multiversal adventure. So I'll just leave it at that.
Real horror tinge. It's definitely horror sci-fi. And speaking of which, have you sampled the Apple TV Plus adaptation yet?
Not yet. So my wife is now reading Dark Matter, and as soon as she's done with it, which should be very soon, we will both watch the show. And I just heard that Dark Matter got picked up for a second season, and it goes beyond the events of the book. So I'm very curious, having now read the book, I'm very curious to know like what they could possibly do. I have one theory or one just sort of weird idea of what they could do, but what do you make of that as somebody who's read the book?
Since Blake Crouch is a showrunner on the show, I feel like, okay, at least the guy who wrote the original book is pulling the shots here. Because that book's a pretty complete story. It kind of, you know, it, it it has an ending that, you know, without spoiling anything, has an air of mystery to it, but also it's not like demanding for me to know what happens next. I was happy to let those characters conclude. Mm-hmm. But if Blake Crouch thinks there's more story to be told, I'm down. And I know I have not seen all of the show yet. I was going to talk about it when I've seen more of it. But Jeremy Mathai, one of our resident writers on Slash Film, who has not read the book, loves the show. Like his reaction to the show was the reason why I read the book. So if the show is that high quality and they think there's more story to tell, then, you know, and Blake Crouch is on board, then yeah, let's see more Dark Matter.
Okay. Yeah. So stand by for more of that. I'm not sure when season 2 of Dark Matter is supposed to come out, but I know they just announced it relatively recently. So it'll probably be, I don't know, several months, if not a year or whatever, but stay tuned for that. Jacob, what have you been reading though?
I read The Situation Room by George Stephanopoulos. George Stephanopoulos he worked in the Clinton administration, and he's been a journalist, a broadcast journalist since then. And The Situation Room is a book that tracks the history of the White House Situation Room, the room in the White House basement where the president can, like, essentially assemble everybody and have a, what's going on in the situation. You know, there's been an attack here, there's been an event here, and the crisis area, essentially. And the book, you know, tracks each presidency from JFK, when the Situation Room was built, all the way up through the Biden administration. And each chapter is a different presidency and explores, you know, a key moment or a key event that was tracked within that room. And this book's good. I think what holds it back is I don't think Stephanopoulos is a particularly gifted writer. Like, I think there are nonfiction writers out there who can really spin their nonfiction in a way where I'm like just hanging every word, where Stephanopoulos is just not an exciting writer. Like, compare him to, like, you know, Patrick Radenkeef or Adam Higginbottom or other writers I've talked about on this show, David Graham. He just doesn't have the way with words to, like, really make this exciting. Mm-hmm. The information, though, is still good. I was really compelled by the plain information being revealed. The stuff about, like, there's a section, the Reagan chapter dwells on when Reagan was shot in the assassination attempt that he survived. There was a recorder in the room, in the situation room, as his staff tried to figure out what to do next, because George H.W. Bush, who was the vice president, was on a plane when he was shot. This is before cell phones, before computers, so there was nobody running the country for a number of hours. And these recordings have been previously not explored or published, and it's wild to see what happened. The people butting heads and yelling and screaming and trying to figure out how to run the country when the president and vice president are both not around. Genuinely wild stuff, but like I said, presented in a way where I wish it was more gripping as an actual narrative. Other chapters, I found the chapter about the Carter administration to be really interesting, because that was where Iran hostage situation was played out there. The chapter about the Obama administration dealing with assassination of bin Laden was really compelling stuff, especially if you've seen the famous photo of Obama and Hillary Clinton and Biden and everybody else, like, just watching that screen intently. That's the situation. Mm-hmm. It's a funny thing. It's not even like a Dr. Strangelove-esque, you know, overlit giant table. It's literally this plain beige room where things happen. But just word of warning, if you're like me, the Donald Trump chapter, which covers January 6th from the POV of the folks in Situation Room, as they realize that the president is not going to help and they're sitting there trying to figure out what to do, is infuriating stuff. So just, if you're already on edge politically, like I think so many of us are, it may be a chapter you may want to hold off on for now.
Yeah. Okay. So the book is called
To Reaffirm Why You're So Angry. I don't know anymore.
Who knows? The book is called The Situation Room. So check that out if you're interested. What else have you been reading?
I read Silo and its sequel book, Shift, by Hugh Howey. Continuing, I have not read the third book, Dust, but I plan to soon. This is a book series that was the source material for Silo, the Apple TV Plus show. Speaking of Apple TV Plus sci-fi shows based on books, Ben, I know this has become a broken record on this, but I've just been reading so many books based on Apple TV Plus shows recently. And generally, I think Apple TV Plus seems to have good taste in books, because Silo is very good. It is. If you watched Fallout, the Amazon Prime show, and said, that was good, but which was a bit more serious, that's kind of the vibe with Silo is. It's Fallout with a bit more serious edge. Rebecca Ferguson plays a woman who is drawn into a conspiracy in this underground silo in which she lives in the post-apocalypse, trying to figure out the nature of why they're in the silo, what happened above, etc. The book has really incredible world building. I was so gripped by the details of this world. The thing I could forgive, the fact that the characters may be maybe a bit thin compared to other books, because I was so interested in their inhabitants and how this world came to be. And the sequel, Shift, is a big left turn. It's a giant swing. It's a prequel and a sequel and an in-betweenquel. It's all of the things playing with timelines. I didn't find it as good as Silo, but as somebody who's interested in this world, I did find its revelations very interesting. I will say that this is also a really good example of an adaptation being done really well. So I have not finished the first season of Silo on Apple TV Plus just yet, but I do like it. And what's interesting is that the first episode of Silo, the first like hour-long episode, is about two pages of the book expanded. A character remembers some events in the prologue, essentially, before the plot kicks in. And the movie, the book really paced like a movie. It's a quick read. It feels like a 2-hour long movie. So the way that the show is searching the nooks and crannies for storylines and characters to fill a 10 you know, episode season of TV is really interesting and a good example of it being done well. Because the Silo show does not feel like needlessly expanded. It just feels like it is adapting the stuff in between sentences, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I recommend the book and I recommend the show, even though, like I said, the show is far more detailed and slower paced than the book is, but probably in a good way. So yeah, Silo, Shift, and Silo, the TV show, all worth your time.
Excellent. All right, let's take a break and then we'll be back to talk about what we've been watching.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
All right, I finally finished the Thin Man movies. I watched Song of the Thin Man, which is the, I think, sixth and final, or maybe seventh and final entry in this long-running franchise from the 30s and 40s. This is about Nick and Nora Charles, played by William Powell and Myrna Loy, this husband and wife sort of detective duo, basically. This movie, unfortunately, kind of limps to the finish line. You can kind of tell that the franchise has lost steam. All the actors obviously are a little bit older, and the banter, which between those two characters specifically, which is like one of the core delights of these movies, is basically just a shadow of what it used to be. So that was kind of depressing. And the mystery itself at the center of this story just isn't quite as compelling as some of the other ones that we've seen in these movies before. So yeah, like I said, a little bit of a limp to the finish line. Song of the Thin Man, not my favorite in this franchise. Kind of, I don't know. I would have to think about a final ranking, but this is definitely either the worst or the second worst one, I would say. But overall, I really enjoyed these movies and would recommend people at least check out the first several of them. If you like the first one, you'll know what you're in for, because that's the vibe largely across most of these movies. Have you ever seen any of these Thin Man movies, Jacob? Have I asked you that already?
Which I think we've discussed this before, but this is one of my big blind spots. It's one of those things where I'm so intimately familiar with the parodies of, yeah, you know, of these type of stories. Like, I remember the podcast Thrilling Adventure Hour used to have a segment that was a parody of Thin Man. I found so funny with Paul F. Tompkins, and it was just, I remember getting the jokes because I was familiar with the overall pop culture osmosis vibes of these movies, but I've never actually seen them. So
I've never heard that podcast. Now I need to get to dive into that. That sounds great. I love Paul F. Tompkins.
Yeah, Thrilling Adventure Hour has a very big backlog. We're on tangent here, but essentially was a podcast that did live performances of old timey radio shows. Like, the idea was like it was live in Los Angeles, but each show was essentially a parody of a like 1930s 1940s radio show. And Beyond Belief was one of the segments where it's Paul F. Tompkins and Paget Brewster, who I best know from the sixth season of Community, but she's been in a lot of things, play this fast-talking, high-drinking, very loving couple who solve supernatural mysteries. And I remember it being like a, what if the Thin Man was the X-Files? It's kind of the vibe of it. And it being very, awesome. Very funny. And that was one of the recurring segments in addition to some others. But yeah, so it's one of the things where I remember listening to that and going, oh, this is a Thin Man. This is a Thin Man parody. But also very vividly realizing, oh, I actually haven't seen a Thin Man. So
I would say check out the first one, and I'd be curious to know what you make of it, especially having all of that information. Because sometimes going back to something like that, when you've absorbed all the stuff about the parodies, going back to the original thing can kind of be disappointing. So I wonder how it would play for you, having that experience already. Okay, the next thing I watched is a movie called The Cheap Detective, which I watched on Amazon Prime Video, and it is a parody of Casablanca and the Maltese Falcon. And it stars Peter Falk as the Humphrey Bogart type of figure. And I'm not really going to get into the whole labyrinthine workings of the plot of this thing, because like most noir things, it's like overly complicated. And it would just sound insane if I tried to describe all of it. But I will read you some of the names of the cast members in this thing. So obviously you've got Peter Falk leading the charge. We also have Madeline Kahn, Louise Fletcher, Anne Margaret, Eileen Brennan, Sid Caesar, Dom DeLuise, Abe Vigoda, Stockard Channing shows up, and James Cromwell has a very, very small role in this. Jonathan Banks pops up for like 1 second, and Scatman Crothers is in this as well. So like the cast is out of this world. So if you are familiar with the milieu of the Bogart mysteries, you know, like those kinds of classic Bogart movies, I would say this is pretty funny and definitely worth sticking around for, because if for no other reason than just the cast is really incredible. So I'm guessing you haven't seen this one, Jacob. This was pretty obscure to me. I'd never even really heard of this before.
Yeah, this is new to me. And where did you say you watched this?
It's on Amazon Prime Video right now. It's directed by somebody named Robert Moore, but it's written by Neil Simon. So it has a little bit of whatever cachet to it, I guess, in those terms. But yeah, The Cheap Detective is the name of the movie. And one of the things I was kind of laughing at is like, it's so indebted to the movies that it's parodying that I was trying to imagine watching this movie without having seen Casablanca or Maltese Falcon or in The Big Sleep or anything like that. Or To Have and Have Not, you know, any of the classic Bogart stuff. And this movie would just be like completely incomprehensible to people watching it under those circumstances. So make sure you've, I guess, done the work, so to speak, if you want to get the most out of The Cheap Detective.
The cast alone feels like I should at least poke my head in this movie, if not watch the whole thing.
Yeah, and I think you get a good sense of the sense of humor of the movie in the first couple minutes, too. So, like, if you are kind of rolling your eyes and being like, all right, I'm not really on board with what's going on here, then absolutely pull the plug, because it's just more of that basically for the whole film. So yeah, keep that in mind as you decide whether or not to check that one out. And then lastly, I wanted to mention a movie that came out a couple years ago called Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes. Have you ever heard of this, Jacob?
This was I can't remember if it was South by Southwest or Fantastic Fest where it was playing, and it was the big discovery of the fest. Everybody was talking about it. Everybody was like, make sure you find time to see it. They kept adding screenings. But I was there for work, and every time it was rescheduled or a new screen was added, they intentionally put it up against a major premiere or a big draw, because they wanted, you know, draw the crowds around. That way people would be, oh, I won't go, I'll skip the big premiere to go see the big buzzy title instead. So in case of work, I had to go see the big, you know, premieres instead of the buzzy titles, and I did not catch up with it. But people loved this movie on the ground. So I'm curious to see how you feel a couple years removed from that.
It's so good. It's so good. It's only 71 minutes long. I think it's a Japanese movie. And it is about this guy who works in a cafe. He owns this cafe. And all of a sudden, he discovers that there's a monitor downstairs in the cafe. And then his computer monitor is upstairs in the apartment that is above the restaurant where he works. And there's a link, a magic link that's never really explained, between these two monitors, where one of them shows what happens 2 minutes into the future. And so the movie is presented in a series of what appear to be like a long continuous shot. You can tell that there are a couple little cuts here and there. But I was really mesmerized by this movie because it's incredibly low budget, but super creative and really fun, and the sci-fi ideas that sort of explode out of this thing really had me engaged and thinking about things in a really new way, and kind of like very just impressed with what is very, very obviously a really, really small movie, but like a perfect example of what you can do with just sheer creativity when you don't really have a ton of other resources. So I cannot recommend this highly enough. I will say, though, that I had this pulled up to watch on Amazon Prime Video. I started watching it there, and these characters were speaking in Japanese, and I was like, huh, there are no subtitles here. I wonder if I'm just not supposed to be grasping what they're, if I'm purposely not supposed to understand what they're saying here, and like maybe a couple minutes in, the subtitles will kick on, and they just never did. So I pulled it up on Tubi, where it's also streaming right now, and right out of the gate, there actually were subtitles there. So I'm not sure what's going on with the Amazon transfer or whatever the file that they've uploaded there. I would recommend not watching it there unless you're fluent in Japanese. So I would recommend checking out Tubi and searching for Beyond the Infinite 2 minutes. It's, yeah, like I said, 71 minutes long, just really, really creative and fun. One of the best sci-fi movies I've seen in a long time, even though it's got to be one of the cheapest as well. So it reminds me a lot of One Cut of the Dead in terms of the long continuous shot aspect of it, and some of the being able to like pull off something really creative with not a ton of resources. So
like people come and saying, oh my goodness, this is the new One Cut of the Dead. And I've talked about One Cut of the Dead on this show before, maybe it's been a minute, but that's one of my favorite movies of the century so far. So that's maybe the comparison I need to finally get back to seeing this.
Yeah, so check it out. I would love to know what you think about it, Jacob. What have you been watching recently?
Because of my New York trip, I missed the opening weekend for Alien Romulus, so I caught up with it. And I feel like the Slash Film team is very divided on this, ranging from loved it to kind of hated it. And I put myself on the upper level here. I think Alien Romulus is a real good time for the movies. I don't think it's as sophisticated as some of the others. And I guess that's my question for you, Ben. Do we want something that's thematically ambitious but a failure, like Alien 3, or something that just says, I'm a horror movie, I want to be scary and gross, and pulls it off like Alien Romulus does? Because I'm happy with Alien Romulus just being a really effective spook house movie, as opposed to, you know, swinging for the fences like Alien 3 did, or Alien Resurrection, another film I think swings for the fences and fails. Where do you fall on the Alien scale of ambition versus pulling it off, with the understanding that the first two films kind of aren't in the question because they somehow managed to do both?
Yeah, exactly. I really enjoyed Alien Romulus, and actually the more I think about it, the more I like it, because it is that sort of contained, it tells you what it's going to do and then just does it to a really, really high level. You pose a really interesting question, though, because I don't know whether I would actually prefer to see somebody like Ridley Scott, or even a different filmmaker this time, just kind of peel back the layers of what this thing is and kind of like get into its guts a little bit and like shake things up and sort of, because that's what Prometheus and Alien Covenant did, right? Like what Ridley Scott did when he returned to this franchise all these years later was basically upend it and like turn it into this whole philosophical other thing, which is really fascinating from a meta perspective for people like us to think about what that means for Ridley Scott, the director, to do that with the iconography that he established all those years ago and like track his career and his interests over time and all that kind of stuff, right? But like on a pure movie making, I like watching this level, Alien Romulus pretty much did it for me when Prometheus and Alien Covenant did not. So I don't know. I'm torn because like viscerally, I love the haunted house aspect of what Romulus gives us. But maybe intellectually, I like the idea of the, you know, going deep and getting into the guts kind of thing. So I don't know. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Yeah, I'm torn because I think Prometheus and Alien 3, I think are both in a similar box in that they're filmmakers taking big swings and failing. I think Fincher fails because the studio did not have his back and did not support his vision. And Prometheus fails because it is that script just is not fully baked for the ideas on display in that movie. I like Covenant more, but Covenant's barely an alien film. It's really Scott exploring his own weird ideas in a really, really philosophical way, just using alien iconography to get it made at a massive budget. So I admire the nerve of that. But yeah, I think that Alien and Aliens, as great as they are, they're magnificent films. They're also good times at the movies. They're just fun. They're just like, they work as like I'm going to sit down and have a good time watching this. And you can explore the bigger, grander ideas in the aftermath. And I don't think Romulus is as, you know, thematically rich as Alien or Aliens, but it's definitely the first film in the franchise in a long time to just have to just be fun, to just be a good time with the movies. Mm-hmm. And I as much as I like some of the other entries, it's one of the things where it's like, oh yeah, this Alien and Aliens weren't giant cultural touchstones because they were, you know, thoughtful and thematically and irrelevant, in which they were and still are. They were initially giant hits because they were really fucking good. And Romulus, I'm not sure if it deserves a fucking good, but it is good. And Fede Alvarez is a really strong technical filmmaker. The scares, the movie are on point. I love the practical monsters. That third act is just bananas. Yeah, we covered this film pretty extensively on the site, so you can find lots of writing about it now. But I'm very pro Romulus, and I'm not even necessarily mad at the Easter eggs. And I know, like, Chris has gone on the record about how he thinks it's the greatest hits collection of Alien. And I'm not sure I agree. I think that outside of maybe a handful of little Easter eggs, I think Romulus feels, you know, just fresh enough for me. So this gets my thumbs up, and I don't know. To paraphrase, Ryan Scott, our box office expert, is not on this podcast right now. So I'll think like him for a second and say, Alien Romulus costs like half as much as Alien Covenant, and it's going to make a lot more at the box office. And I really hope this means that the future of the Alien franchise is looking up, because Covenant was a big disappointment on that level. And that's the thing, we can love it when a big franchise takes a big swing, like Alien Covenant did. But things were like, if audiences don't respond, what does that mean for future films? What does it mean for the longevity of it? The answer for Covenant was that, you know, it just meant that years and years and years go by where nobody touches Alien again. Mm-hmm. And that's where, like, you know, as a fan, it becomes like this really a real internal struggle for me of like, I want this to be accessible enough to make money, but I want to be ambitious enough to be good. And I don't know. This is why the Alien franchise is so interesting, is each one of these movies has its own philosophy, its own way about why it was made and how it was made. And I love that Romulus is making me monologue about it, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely. Right there with you. All right. So tell me about this next movie. I've never heard of this one.
Oh, this is a TV program, Ben. It's called The 1%. Okay. It is a Amazon Prime game show that I really, really like. I saw this because a YouTube video popped up where it's like, Patton Oswalt answers your biggest internet questions. One of those things you see on YouTube all the time. And I love Patton Oswalt, so I clicked on it. And turned out he was there to promote The 1% Club, a new game show that he hosts. And I love Patton Oswalt, and I'll at least sample everything he does. So I figured, oh, I'll go check out The 1% Club and see what this game show is all about. And first things first, because Patton Oswalt has made a career out of comedy and, you know, playing characters, for the first episode of this show, it felt like a show within a show. Like, you know, if a 30 Rock character went on a game show and the game show host would play Patton Oswalt, that was the vibe I was getting, because I kept on waiting for Patton Oswalt to reveal himself to be sarcastic or reveal himself to be like playing a character or for something dark to happen. But I realized, oh no, he's just playing game show host. Patton Oswalt is just playing a super old school MC for questions here. So once I got over that and got over like, oh, he's just being his jovial self and not playing a character, I was able to embrace The 1% Club for what it is, which is I think a genuinely unique game show. The setup is that 100 people are in the audience with tablets. They're all asked questions. They get progressively harder. The questions are sourced from surveys that they've taken around the country, where questions that 90% of the audience got right in the survey are the easiest and come first, then 80% and 70%, all the way down to 1%. And people who get the 1% question right win a share of $100,000. So if two people are in the end and they both get the 1% question right, then they split the $100,000. If it's one person, gets all the money, and so on. But the questions are interesting because they're not necessarily trivia questions. They're riddles and questions that involve math and logic and, you know, puzzle solving. There's like no questions about like, you know, who starred in this movie or who invented this thing. It is entirely stuff where everything you need to know is in the question. It's about, you know, essentially brain teasers, for lack of a better term, but they get progressively harder. And I found, at first you'll be watching the 90% questions and be like, what is this baby show? This is so easy. Then you get down to like the 20% questions and it's like, oh my God, and you know, like legitimately try to like talk it out and figure it out in your head to like try to find a solution. my wife and I ended up, we reached a point where like we actively try to play along, actually try to like burn our brain solving the tougher ones. And there are some episodes where we solve all of them. We're like, man, we should have been on there. We would have won that 100,000. And there are times where we get our ass kicked at question, you know, at a 75% level. So it's, if you're like, if you like a good game show and you are not a trivia person, but like the idea of competition and like, you know, giving your brain a decent workout or proving you're just really smart or smarter than me, at least, the 1% Club, all 10 episodes of season one are streaming on Prime. I had a good time. This was my, this was our like dinner time show over the past week.
Okay, excellent, man. I don't think I've ever heard of that before, but that sounds fun. So 1% Club on Prime, check that out. What have you been playing, Jacob, in our last category here?
All right, I'll be fast in this because I don't know how many people care about video games, but the DLC, the sequel content package for Elden Ring, the giant, critically acclaimed, famously difficult action RPG, came out a few weeks ago. And I had not beaten Elden Ring. In fact, I played it to near completion when it came out 2 years ago. I was near the very, very end of the game. I had like, you know, over 100 hours put into it. I get toward the very, very end, hit a boss I could not beat. And famously, if you've ever played From Software games, the makers of this game, you know, behind Dark Souls and Bloodborne and Sekiro, Elden Ring is famously really, really hard. And the boss battles are extremely difficult. And I banged my head against this boss, and I said, I'll beat this later. And I never did. So 2 years pass, the DLC hits, and I try to decide, okay, is this a window for me to jump back in? Or should I try to restart from the beginning? No, I have 100 hours in this game. I can't start over. Jesus Christ, what do I do? So I bought the DLC, and it took me a few weeks, but I did beat it. It was incredibly difficult. Then my character was so overpowered from the DLC that I went back to the base game and steamrolled everything else in the base game. And after 2 years, I finally beat Elden Ring. Please clap.
So do you have a like a genuine sense of accomplishment when there's been such a huge gap between starting and finishing, or is it more like relief, or like what's the emotion there?
A little bit of both. The relief, because now I know I've seen the ending, I've seen the credits roll, I know I've done it, but also a sense of accomplishment because, you know, I've talked about this before on this show, and if you're familiar with video games at all, you've probably heard this as well. But From Software, they're a Japanese developer, and they make hard games. And if you listen to their studio head, who's also directs most of their games, he talks about how he wants to be a sense of accomplishment. He doesn't want you to just do something and move on. Things are hard in From Software games because they want you to genuinely get better at it, truly appreciate the design you're seeing, and, you know, feel like you've overcome something. And that sounds like it could be pretentious. And at first, I thought, when I first started playing these games, I was like, oh, goodness, is this just going to be hard for the sake of being hard? And I'm not, and people say, like, you get good at video games is a philosophy that I think is oftentimes really vile and leads to, like, people being rude to each other on the internet when people need help. It's a whole thing. But I will say this much. There are areas in these games, Elden Ring, but also Bloodborne and Dark Souls and other games in this, you know, in their you know, ouvre, where I can tell you, I can close my eyes and guide you through various areas in those games. I can describe the art design, the production design, how the enemies move, where to turn left, where to turn right, how to find a secret. Whereas there are games, like, I'll use a game I really like, The Last of Us, a game I love, but you play it once, you walk through a beautiful area, and you forget about it because it was there for one thing. Mm. And that's very cinematic, the idea of there being one image, and you see it once, you move on. But the idea that a video game is difficult because it wants you to feel the repetition and wants you to genuinely learn, see, and appreciate the design at hand, whether it be an aesthetic design or a physical game design, is really unique and beautiful. And it's the idea of a game being a game and a game not being a movie. And that's kind of how I've learned to embrace difficulty, is that I am not here because it's hard. I'm here because I'm going to learn to appreciate this, sometimes over hours. But I don't know. Does that make sense to you, Benny? I know you're a far more casual gamer than I am.
It does. Yeah. I mean, it sounds maybe vaguely aspirational to me, but I'm not sure that I have the patience and or free time and or willingness to take that leap with that sort of mentality of like, I'm just going to enjoy the designs here and the, you know, being in this world. And like, I feel like I'm a much more impatient gamer than that. I'm kind of like, all right, if this guy beats me six times in a row, I got to like go to the internet and figure out how I can work around this and accomplish this goal or whatever. So it sounds like these games are absolutely not for me at all.
I still use guides. In fact, there's this whole thing like where certain segments of the fan base are like, oh, you shouldn't use guides. But then the game designer came out and said, nope, you should use guides if you want to. And like, and also the game designer has said that he's the worst player at his company. And they test the game by if he can beat it, they assume that the worst players can. So it's one of those things where like, okay, the game guy who made this game is like me, somebody who's going to bang his head against it repeatedly and probably not be good at it, but eventually get through it. So that's kind of where I fell. Like, I am not a great video gamer. I'm not inherently skilled at games, but I still found myself completely addicted and in love with some of the hardest games of all time. So I don't know what that means, but I do know that I appreciate it though.
Excellent. All right. Well, that's the Elden Ring DLC, and then the base game Elden Ring that you can get. What system do you play that on, Jacob?
I play it on PlayStation 5, but it's okay. Available for all the main consoles.
Okay. That's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about pretty much everything we talked about at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a few things in the show notes too. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all tomorrow.